I want to thank the people who have joined us today for this. I think it's the third conversation that I've had with essays coming from our issue on cancellation. As you can see, Sapir is not just an online journal, it is a very handsome physical product. That cover is hand-drawn. Had conversations with Lionel Shriver, the great novelist and essayist who has wonderful essay in this issue. I had a conversation with Professor Joshua Katz on the culture of the canceled. And I'm really thrilled to welcome back David Wolpe, who has really, I think, a landmark essay because it really grounds the subject of cancellation in Jewish text and thought. To err is human, to disagree, Jewish. It's a wonderful, I think, really genuinely, not just important, I think it's a seminal essay that provides thoughtful readers with specifically Jewish grounding in the question of how we approach disagreement and debate and heresy and opinions with which we furiously disagree. So with that in mind, just those of you who have participated before know that the way we do these is that I will have a conversation with David for the next 35 minutes or so. After about 35 minutes, maybe 40 minutes, I'm going to turn it over to questions. So there is a Q&A function at the bottom of your screens, and you can start putting in questions there. And I'll be periodically taking a look at them. And then once David and I are done chatting, I will try to get to as many of the questions as possible. And I will always try to make sure to ask not just the softballs, but the tough questions, too. So David, as I think everyone here knows, is the senior rabbi at the Sinai Temple in Los Angeles. But you will be at Harvard University next year, which is downward mobility, but we won't say that too much.
My congregants think so too.
They might not be entirely wrong. I want to begin with a term that you offered, David, which I thought was so striking and so useful. And the term you mentioned is methodological pluralism. Can you just unpack that idea for those listening in?
One of the ways, first of all, thank you for the conversation and the opportunity to talk, and for Sapir in general, which I want you people to know, I read the issue from cover to cover, and there are many wonderful essays in it, including some that you would not normally assume would be in an issue about cancellation, like Saul Rosenberg's, that gave me insights into Faulkner that I wouldn't have had. Really a wonderful essay, and Brett's contribution among the stellar framings of the issue. Methodological pluralism is that there are different ways of arriving at the same, at attacking the same question. And so it isn't only that we come to different conclusions, it's that we think about things in a different way. And one of the glories of living in America that has been unfortunately shorn of much of its potential is that you have such a diverse citizen body that you can actually hear in real time people thinking through issues from different vantage points and with different tools. And that allows you to understand that your own thinking is one mode of thinking as opposed to the correct way to go about it.
So offer some examples of methodological pluralism from within the Jewish tradition.
So one clear example is legal thought versus philosophical thought, or midrashic thought. Those are three different ways of approaching the same thing. So I will, I'll give you, let's see, an example from the story of Jacob that we just read about, where the angel wrestles with Jacob and he injures him in his thigh. So the legal implication of that is that you're not supposed to eat, you know, Jews, to get filet mignon, kosher filet mignon is very expensive because you have to remove that section of the meat, which I'm told is difficult to do. It has implications, legal implications for kashrut. And you could read that story as, this is telling us what we may eat, basically. You can read the story as a story of self-transformation. Jacob is wrestling with himself because it says, Vayivater Yaakov Levado, Jacob was left alone. And then it says, Vayayavek Ishimo Adalot HaShachar, that a man wrestled with him until the coming of dawn. So you can read it psychologically. This is Jacob's wrestling with himself. You can read it as an angel. Some people read it, the Midrash reads it as Esau's angel wrestling with him. And finally, you can read it as the birth of the Israelite people, since Jacob goes in as Jacob and comes out as Israel, which is, of course, the name of the Jewish people. All of those modes of seeing the story have legitimacy that don't cancel out the other modes. The way that the rabbis put it is shivim panim l'Torah. The Torah has 70 faces. And different minds approach the story in different ways and see it differently. If I can give you one capsule summary of this. So Rambam, Nachmanides, says, prophets only prophesy in visions and dreams. Along comes Ramban Nachmanides, about 100 years later, and says, but if that's true, then why does Jacob limp after he has this vision? It's just a dream, right? Afterwards, so it isn't just a dream, it's a reality. It actually was a physical encounter. So there's a debate between two great theological minds about the same event. And then along comes a third named the Ritva, still later, and says, well, some dreams are so powerful, they affect the way you actually move in the world, and tries to reconcile them. But this is like an instance of methodological pluralism operating on one event in one story at one time. And the Jewish tradition is saturated in such disparate views that ultimately, I think, make it a richer, more embracing, and more interesting and enlivening tradition.
One of the other points that you make, reminiscent, or I should say, which reminds us that how rooted American traditions are, particularly legal traditions, in Jewish thought and practice, is the habit of preserving the dissenting views. And obviously, this is what we do in our jurisprudence. It's what the Supreme Court does. It's how mistakes are rectified decades after the fact. I always think of John Marshall Harlan's great dissent in Plessy v. Ferguson, which ultimately became the basis for Brown versus Board. Why? What is it, you think, at the beginning of the Jewish tradition, which led Jews to see the importance of preserving that dissent? Because that's not something you find in many other faith traditions.
So I can't say for sure, but I have a guess.
Okay.
That one of the things that the Torah distinguishes itself in, as opposed to other sacred scripture, is that it presents a sovereign God and yet allows human beings to object to, argue, and sometimes even, in a sense, out-argue God. So when God is going to destroy Sodom, God says to Abraham, I'm going to destroy the city. And Abraham says, well, what if there are 50 righteous people, 40, gets him down to 10. And then utters that great line, will the judge of all the earth not do justice? So it's a direct challenge to God's justice and is very much a dissenting opinion. And even more dramatically, in some ways, is that God wants to, after the golden calf incident, God wants to wipe out the Jewish people. And Moses stops him and says, if you're going to wipe them out, then wipe me out too. I have no interest in this. If you're not going to basically be forgiving of the people. Now, theologically, you can read that as God was trying to evoke that reaction. That's why he said it. He wanted to give them a chance to speak that way. Fine. It doesn't really matter what the theology behind it is. The idea behind it is that the reader would say, you know, if you can challenge God, I can challenge this rabbi. And in fact, even the Sanhedrin was set up that way. We're told that when there was a capital case in the Sanhedrin, the most junior rabbis would speak first because they were afraid if the senior rabbi spoke first, the juniors would just go along with what they said. So they had to express their own opinion. And that's because if you don't have that happen, you're going to lose a lot of valuable and interesting things. You know, and I know as people who have taught classes, there's always a kid sitting in the back who doesn't say anything and seems to have nothing to say. And then one day you either call on him or he pipes up and says something brilliant and startling. And you go, oh my God, there was so much there that I didn't know. And I think that the Talmud just makes this assumption that anybody who is interested enough, passionate enough, learned enough to be among the circle of rabbis has something to say that is worth preserving, even if it's wrong.
So I want to talk about this, because it also seems to me, almost from an evolutionary perspective, that it's a method of handling the perils of schismatism, if you will, which is that you by preserving within the fold those who disagree with you, you are able to keep people in who might otherwise be out. And certainly the history of other traditions is, well, you have there's a schism and someone goes and founds effectively a different church. Judaism has a different way of dealing with schismatics, but that does not mean that there isn't a line somewhere. There is excommunication in the Jewish tradition. Obviously, we have a bad history of using it against the wrong people because we're the morons who excommunicated Spinoza. I just want to say,
in our defense, I mean, yes, Spinoza was, but in our defense, we don't know exactly why Spinoza was excommunicated. So even though he turned out to be in philosophical history both very important and seemingly an exceedingly honorable and gentle human being, right? Those are the reports that we get. We don't know enough of the story to know exactly what happened. And of course, the community was probably scared. A lot of excommunication had to do not with the person, but with proving to the outside Gentile community, we will take care of this. Don't worry, you don't have to come down hard on us. So I mean, you're probably right. Spinoza was a wrong turn. And modern scholars have certainly made that case pretty persuasively. But if I wanted to be an advocate for the other side, I would say we still are lacking some crucial information. However, on the larger question, there are excommunications, but the truth is that even excommunicated groups like the Vilna Gaon would excommunicate the Hasidim. They still stayed in the Jewish world and ultimately, you know, became very important in the Jewish world. And it's very, very few fringe groups, the Karaites, early on the Samaritans, whose beliefs were so radically different from mainstream Judaism that they got excommunicated and really became separate. The other, by the way, obviously schismatic group whose beliefs were different and they became separate were believers in Jesus. But apart from that, Jews, even when they excommunicated each other, which they have an unfortunate tendency to do, they still all somehow managed to stay in the Jewish world. And part of it, I think, is this sense that, you know, the the heresy of one generation can be the commonplace of the next, which we've seen again, again, and again.
And was that a wisdom that was as apparent 500, 1,000, 1,500 years ago as it is now? I mean, now it's very easy to say, and this is a point you make in your piece, that, you know, if 2,000 years ago, someone who said that slavery is wrong would be seen as unusual, to say the least, if not outlandish. Now, of course, it's people, you know, profoundly recognize the wrongness of slavery, just as we recognize the wrongness of of laws prohibiting marriage between races and so right. on. But was this a thought that was present to our distant forebears, that outrageous thoughts could eventually become a part of tradition, would eventually have a place of honor within the broader community?
So I think there's a sort of underlying question to this, which is debated among scholars, not only among Jewish scholars. There's a classic book in Greek studies, Did the Greeks Believe Their Myths?
Yeah.
Same thing here. It's like, when the rabbi said something, did they say it with awareness that it was their opinion, as opposed to assuming that it was, in fact, they were channeling God's word? And it's not entirely clear which is actually true, because sometimes there's this very famous story about, I won't go through the whole thing, but basically this rabbi argues with God, and God keeps giving signs. God makes a river run backward. God makes a tree lean on and on, God's trying to show this rabbi's wrong. And finally, the rabbi looks up at the heavens and says, he quotes a verse in Deuteronomy, Lo b'shamayim, Torah is not in the heavens. In other words, stay out of our debate. So the aftermath of that is that God laughs and says, my children have defeated me. Now, something like that, if you ask, did this person who wrote this story really believe that this happened? Or did they understand that ideas actually change over time and that that's okay and part of the design? Very hard to say. But later on, it's clear, especially like in the 17, 1800s, when Hasidism at first was just anathema to the Jewish world and then became very popular in the Jewish world, I think it became clear that ideas that start off as obviously wrong, not just wrong, but obviously wrong and heretical and bad, can in fact prove themselves to be quite the opposite. And so I don't know at what point it changed, but the seeds were always there for, guess what, guys? I know we always said this, but actually that might be true. And I, just as one little caveat, again, so the Torah says you should stone rebellious sons. And a very famous passage in the Talmud gives all sorts of qualifications. Well, the son has to be this, and he has to be warned that way, and he has to be drunk, and he has to be so on. And then, not satisfied that they have eliminated through the death of 1,000 qualifications, the possibility that a son, they end up the sugya, the section of the Talmud that discusses this, ends up by saying the rebellious son, lo haya belo nivra, never was and never will be. And why then does God put it in the Torah? They say, because you get reward for studying it. It sounds to me a lot like they knew that was in there. They didn't want it to be in there. So they were going to make sure one way or another that it was no longer in there.
So this actually raises, you led me in the direction of, or you led in the direction of my next question, which is really a hypothesis I have, which I wanted to run by you, which is that one reason why it is more difficult to practice the kind of excommunicative arts, if you will, in Jewish tradition as it is in other religions, is that Judaism has a quality of peoplehood rather than the kind of universalism so that, you know, I might have, my children might have vehement disagreements with one another, usually on less lofty issues than theological ones, but they are ultimately forced to recognize one another as siblings. So they are definitionally a part of the family, and whether their heresy moves in one direction or another, there's an obligation that goes beyond simply the intellectual questions that they are bonded in blood and lineage and have a set of obligations to one another that you might say are moral obligations that are more important than differences of opinion.
Yeah, I think that this is the great, I mean, for Christians, this is the great challenge to overcome, to understand the way Jews work, because Judaism is not a religion. It's a, the way that I like, there are lots of formulations, I like to call it a religious family, which is not the same thing. You're not born into a religion. You have to be initiated in it in one way or another, but you're born Jewish. And yet it's not purely an ethnicity, or, I mean, it's not purely a race, because you can't convert to be a different race. So it doesn't exactly have a category in English that fits, but this, I'll give you a really lovely example that from our own, both of our own experience. In the Soviet Union, both Jews and Christians were persecuted, but there was no Christian worldwide movement to save the Christians of the Soviet Union. And the reason that that is so is not because Christians are not as good of people as Jews, but the relation between Christian and Christian is much more tenuous because it's a relation of shared faith. Whereas for Jews, even Jews who are not at all faithful in the Soviet, completely secular, an Orthodox Jew would have very little lifestyle similarity with, that was still a Jew. And because it was familial, it was like, my family is suffering over there, I got to do something about it. And as a result, there was a Soviet Jewry movement that not only freed Soviet Jewry, but was instrumental actually in ending the evil hegemony of the Soviet Union. So the faith is much more capable of being spread worldwide. It's one of the reasons why Judaism is not a huge, to say the least, is not a huge people, but a family is much better at taking care of one another. And so, yes, when you're siblings, it's like, I may not like my sibling, I may think that, but we're always brothers, and that's just, you know, that's destiny.
So let's move to the present, because we now live in an era, I mean, we have for a while, but particularly when it comes to arguments about Israel, but other arguments as well within the Jewish family, where there is a kind of a powerful temptation to excommunicate one another. I mean, I am a frequent sparring, and a frequent debate partner, I guess, with Peter Beinart, and obviously our views on many subjects could not be more different. And a question I'm always asked when I go on stage with him is, well, why do you deign to share the stage with him? Right. And my answer is usually, well, you know, A, because I think these disagreements need to be aired, and I think Peter's a very capable debater, much as I disagree with him, but if I'm going to be true to my view that I'm not in the business of excommunicating points of view I dislike, then I have to engage with them. That's my answer to them. And they will respond by saying his views are so beyond the pale when it comes to Israel that he should not be platformed. And I'd love to hear your thinking on that subject.
I'm much more on your side of that debate. Now, it's trickier when you run a synagogue. Inviting people to your synagogue is a different question, because there you are, to some extent, it's like an implicit endorsement of, you wouldn't bring this person to a synagogue if you didn't think that they were in the ambit of, although I many years ago, after I wrote a very negative review of one of his books, I had Peter Beinart to the synagogue, and we had a feisty exchange. But
Peter's a very decent guy. I mean, I yes. have, right. you know, he's a decent human being with a nice family, and I separate that. I do my best to remember that there is this decent person whose views I just fiercely quarrel.
So one of the things I was going to say is, look, I have a very politically divided congregation, and the advantage I had in understanding them was that I got to know them, as you know, Peter, before I got to know them as political beings. That is, I buried their parents, and I bar mitzvahed their kids, and I visited them in the hospital. And then, you know, then the great political division came up, and I knew they stood on this side, and other people stood on another side. But I already knew that they were like kind, thoughtful, decent human beings with nice families. And so I had to explain to myself how I could understand somebody whose views were very different from mine. And I couldn't put it down to, oh, they're terrible people. Just like you don't do that with Peter, which I think is really important, because as soon as you turn disagreement into moral turpitude, right? They disagree with me, so they're obviously bad. Then you generally, with very few exceptions, you're not engaging with the best arguments of the people who disagree with you. And in this sense, I know this is going to sound very strange to say this, in this sense, like, Hitler and Nazism have totally distorted our moral conversation, because everything you disagree with now becomes the worst possible thing that human beings have ever done.
Yeah.
And that's too bad, because the vast majority of people occupy the middle ground, like we all do. So I did a lot of debates, as you know, about religion and atheism with Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins and a bunch of other people. And I have to say, both Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris and I always had I like to think I was friends with Hitchens, and I certainly consider myself friends with Sam. We don't agree at all. Not only do we not agree, but they make fun of the things that I hold sacred. It goes that far. It's not just that they disagree with it. And still, I at least have a certain empathetic understanding of why they believe the way they do. And I think that that's a good thing. I don't think that's a dangerous thing. And God knows, in our society, we suffer from a vast excess of the opposite.
Yeah, I was with a friend of mine just a few days ago, trying to explain that for all of my personal dislike of the man who now goes by the name the former guy, I don't readily put him in the camp of Mussolini and Hitler, and trying to explain that you can very much dislike someone, disagree with them vehemently, does not mean that they're automatically cast into the very darkest, pool. But I do want to get to this point, because, you know, something you say in your column, in your essay, David, is that at the end of the day, yes, there is a border, right? There are red lines. There are points at which you say, you know what, that's just not a view that I can even begin to engage with. It's not a view I can accept. And I understand we're trying to draw right. The boundaries wide, but at some point there is a boundary. So what are some of those lines?
So I mean, for me, I would not have a debate with somebody who put a swastika inside a Jewish star. With somebody who uses explicit Nazi symbols, I might have a private conversation with them, but I certainly wouldn't have a public debate. I don't have debates with Jews for Jesus. I have very, very, very strong ideological objections to what I see basically as more a marketing scam than a religious approach. And I know those are harsh words, and I'm sure some people won't like them, but that's okay. And I think that essentially the professed desire to harm, to eliminate, to take away the essence of who you are, those are kind of the red lines. Having said that, though, even those kinds of red lines are sometimes adjusted, because as the saying always goes in the Middle East, you know, you don't make peace with your friends, you make peace with your enemies. And so I would say I would err always.
That was Rabin's saying, by the way. I don't think it was a common Middle Eastern saying before.
Well, he was in the Middle East, so. But actually, it turned out that it was his friends, in quotes, and not his enemies, that ended up doing him in. But this is a really important point, because Rabin, of course, was killed by a Jew. Sadat was killed by an Egyptian. It's generally your own people who present the greatest threat to you, not the other, when you engage the other side. By which I mean, it is, and there are all sorts of studies about this, the moderates of each side, right and left, take the most heat from the extremists of their own side. Because
point that David French makes in his essay, Cancellation.
Exactly so, which is a really fine essay, and he's a terrific writer. And so I think, though, that as moderates, you have to be a model sometimes for your own side and say, you can get angry at me, but I still believe that to engage these people is going to broaden the possibility of the conversation and unsilo ourselves. And so and this is part of, and this may open a whole new can of worms, but part of this is words in and of themselves can be incitements to violence, but words are not violence. And to allow people to express themselves, even if they disagree with you, can lead to insights, even if you think you're 100% right.
So let me ask you, let me push you a little further on this. You mentioned Jews for Jesus, people who put swastikas within the Stars of David. That's the former rap star, famous rap star. What about anti-Zionists?
So are you talking about Jewish anti-Zionists or?
Yeah, Jewish anti-Zionists.
I think it gets a little tricky because there are different species of anti-Zionism. I would say that someone who argues for the destruction of the Jewish state, not like I am indifferent, I think Zionism is not great, but someone who argues actively for the destruction of the Jewish state, I wouldn't shout them down from campus. I wouldn't invite them, and I would encourage a college not to invite them. That is, I don't want to restrict their freedom of speech. I wouldn't say they have to shut up, but I would not expand. And here is that important distinction. Not to invite someone is not to restrict their freedom of speech. They can say whatever they want, but I would not platform them, and I wouldn't give them an opportunity to speak if I had any influence out of it. So for example, if UCLA, which is down the street from me, invites somebody who advocates the destruction of the state of Israel, I would say to UCLA, you ought not to invite that person. And I would encourage anybody in my congregation who is influential or in the Jewish community to join me in that. In the same way, by the way, that if somebody was invited to UCLA who said, I believe in the destruction of the nation of France, I would say you shouldn't have that person there. An advocate of destruction is not for me. Is not somebody that I would want to invite. I'll put it that way. That doesn't mean that I'm.
I have to confess, on my side, I have very mixed feelings. In part because I think that the best way to defeat bad arguments is to engage them, and you can't engage them unless you provide them with some kind of platform. You have to take the risk that in platforming them, they're going to persuade, but you also have the opportunity to, if not persuade them, at least expose the error of the way in which they...
Well, are you suggesting to me that you're going to be on the stage with them to argue against it? Then I'd be much more likely to have them come. But if it's you're giving somebody the stage by themselves, then generally the arguments aren't engaged. And we all know that persuasive speakers a la Louis Farrakhan, who is an extraordinarily skilled speaker, can do a lot of damage if nobody says what you're saying is ridiculous and this is why.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, we're going to go to questions shortly, but one more question I'd like to ask in this connection, and I'm sure people will have things that are more contemporary in their orientation, but we've had two major anti-Semitic controversies, well, three really, but let me focus on two. One is the question of Kanye or Ye, who's gone from not just bad to worse, but worse to worser, if that's a word.
Yeah.
Then there's the case of Kyrie Irving, the basketball player who was purveying or making the case for a film. And it just struck me that these are actually distinct cases that should be approached differently, in that one person strikes me as both extraordinarily willful and mentally potentially unwell, but certainly persistent in his prejudices. Another guy just struck me as credulous. Maybe I'm wrong, but that was my general sense. And that the way in which we approach these two personages, even though the situations happened around the same time, ought to be different. I'd like your reaction.
I agree 100%. I once had an Instagram dialogue with an athlete, former basketball player, Steven Jackson, who had made an anti-Semitic remark. And it was clear in the course of it that it wasn't like he had thought this through. You know, it wasn't as though he heard something, it sounded, and in the course of the conversation, his attitude changed. Literally in the course of the conversation. Because first I asked him about his story and what it was like growing up, and then we talked about all sorts of things, and then we got to this. And by the end of it, he was saying, you know, it sounds to me like the kind of thing I said is the kind of thing that people say when they characterize the Black community as all being like this. So there are a lot of cultural memes out there, and we assume sometimes that people do things thoughtfully, even though we often do things thoughtlessly. We have all sorts of opinions about nations and ideas and so on, and know very little about it. And the same is true here. I don't think Kyrie Irving even watched that movie that he linked to, because I know someone who watched it and they said it was an excruciating couple of hours in addition to being hate-filled. And you can't imagine that he sat at home with popcorn and watched that movie. So there's a lot that has to be done in terms of education, outreach, not immediately going to this is a horrible like missile threatened at pointed at the Jewish community that we have to, you know, immediately destroy. And just before we move to the questions, just to say one optimistic thing about anti-Semitism. And I say this at every opportunity, and I think it's really important for people to understand that for most of Jewish history, Jews were the identified other. There were Russians and Jews and Frenchmen and Jews and Germans and Jews and on and on and on, Lithuanians and Jews. But in America, there aren't Americans and Jews. There are lots and lots and lots of different groups, and they have lots of different problems and struggles, as do we. And yes, there are more hate crimes against Jews than any other group, that's true. But still in America, we are enormously successful, overwhelmingly safe, and we have a lot of cultural sway, not just because Jews have cultural sway, but because we have many, many, many allies and friends. And so vigilance is important, but despair is unwarranted. And I think that we're wise enough to keep that in mind.
Whereas in my view, to quote the sage Woody Allen, it's always darkest before it goes absolutely black. we'll see.
We'll disagree. I'm gonna take the optimistic view. I'm not Pollyannish. There are real challenges and real problems, and I deal with them a lot. But as a religious person, I have faith.
Well, let me turn now to the questions, and there's some very good ones. I'm going to start with Gary Lazar, who asks, Rabbi Wolpe, you moderated a great discussion between Jeremy Ben-Ami and Mort Klein at Sinai Temple many years ago. Today, would you ever consider having an anti-Zionist like Jeremy Ben-Ami, I'm not sure he is, but to your temple without a balance from a person of the stature of Mort Klein?
I would have such a person if I was their opposite number. There, I tried to act as a neutral. It was an interesting discussion. I tried to act as a neutral arbiter, and it was a very good discussion, actually, in the end. And they both, I don't mean this to, this is going to sound condescending. I don't mean it to that way. They both behaved themselves very well. Like nobody took cheap shots. Nobody was ad hominem. They really argued their points. I would only do it with some qualified opposition, because I think, as Gary implies with the question, anti-Zionism has unfortunately made many, many strides since those days, and it's scarier now than it was.
Mel Aronoff asks, what is the best way to turn down the temperature between those who insist the greater danger is the anti-Semitism of the right or the left? Good question.
That is a great question. The temperature is turned up not because people evaluate the risk of anti-Semitism differently, but because they're on one or another side of the political divide. That is, I have never heard somebody who's a staunch right winger say, you know what, the right wing is really the biggest threat. And I have never heard somebody who is a staunch left winger say, you know what, the left wing is really the biggest threat. So until we turn down the larger temperature, I'm not sure we're going to turn down this one, because this has become sadly a sort of another form of point scoring against your political rivals. And the people that I want to support are the people who are working against anti-Semitism on both sides of the aisle.
Pamela Peresky, our mutual friend and a contributor to Sapir, asks or says, the concept of peoplehood is an extraordinarily challenging thing to explain. And the expression of Jewish peoplehood is also, I think, among the reasons for grand anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. Now that anti-Semitism is rising, even in the U.S., how should we best discuss Jewish peoplehood, and how can we appropriately grapple with different views regarding the importance or lack thereof of the kinds of anti-Semitic rhetoric we see from Kanye and others? Great question.
I explain peoplehood the way I put it before. Family is a much less charged term in some ways, and in other ways, more charged. So I talk about Jews as a religious family. I mean, you can also say that Jews are a people, but yes, it is a hard thing to explain because we live in modern Western society, and that's not where Israel was shaped and formed and became whatever it became. We're importing cultural categories that don't have an analog in the modern world. And the larger question of how you present ourselves in a way that doesn't evoke a dangerous reaction while still presenting ourselves honestly, as in Jews really do care about one another, and Jews are really successful by and large compared to other groups, even though at least according to the statistics, I see close to 20% of Jews are beneath the poverty line, which I know would shock most people, but is true. The way that you present that, I think, is less important than the way you present the question of hate. Because as soon as you assume that if the Jews could only present themselves a certain way, the hate would diminish, what you're saying is it's really because the Jews present themselves this way that it has spiked. And one of the things that is so crucial for Jews, but also non-Jews, to understand about anti-Semitism is it is a protean hatred. You can hate Jews for being communists, and you can hate Jews for being capitalists. You can hate them for being poor and feckless and not contributing to society, and you can hate them for being rich and successful and running the world. The Nazis thought they were vermin who ran the world. The contradiction there is crazy, but if you hate something in society—
It reminds me of the great John Stewart line is, if Jews run the media, why do we give ourselves such bad press?
Exactly. So anything you hate, you can hate Jews. And I'm not sure that any way we present ourselves alone will ameliorate that. So we just have to do the best we can. And the only single bit of advice that I would offer is, when approached by people who have either anti or adjacent anti-Jewish, a certain humility and inquiry can really help. That is, yelling back is not always the best response. And we do a lot of yelling back.
Well, one point, and if I can add to the answer for a moment, is the United States differs. The American model of citizen and state differs from, say, the French model, to say nothing of the Russian model, in that in the French model, it is the citizen and the state. There are not too many intermediate identities. Whereas the American model has always had a sense that there are many intermediate identities between who you are as a citizen with obligations and loyalties to a particular government and the fullness of your personhood, right? I mean, that's the essence, the beauty of Lincoln, of Washington's letter to the congregation in Newport, yeah, Rhode Island. So yes, I'm an American and a Yankees fan and a Jew and a journalist and a member of my household and a resident of Westchester. I mean, there are a million identities, right, that are not seen as contradicting my the set of obligations I owe Uncle Sam, you know, whether it's taxes or selective service or one thing or another. What's disturbing, though, of course, is that the same people who don't mind identifying themselves, say, as Catholic, because they have a sense of obligation, religious obligations, including obligations to a hierarchy that's established elsewhere, are perfectly happy to cast aspersions or to suggest dual loyalties on the part of the Jews. So the anti-Semitism, right, cuts through the fact that other Americans get to have many identities, but presumably to the anti-Semite, the Jew only gets to have, right, one. Let me turn to Mark Neugbauer. I hope I pronounced that right. Forgive me if I didn't. Rabbi Wolpe, how do the rabbis explain the harem laws in Torah against the nations that the Israelites encountered after the Exodus?
So the rabbis explain it as that was God saying that at the time, and it doesn't apply later, and so it applies only to specific nations. I've often said, you know, that we're fortunate that there are no Canaanites around to talk about what they think about the ancient Israelites. But if you ask me how I explain it, which will not necessarily please either the traditionalists or the non-traditionalists, I would say the ancient world was an extraordinarily violent world, and it was a world of constant conquest. And by the standards of that world, the fact that people were allowed to join Israel was already a huge step forward and concession. But the assumption was that those who didn't would be a constant threat to your people. And so they had to be defeated, or you would never be able to settle peacefully in the land. And unfortunately, that seems to be sort of the rule of the world for a couple thousand years. The one thing that I will say, which people don't always give, just to give us a little credit about something, which I think many people are unaware of, is when God says these are the boundaries of Israel, what that means at the same time is outside of these boundaries is not yours. It not only says inside is yours, but it's the only, as far as I know, it explicitly says you may not be a colonialist power. Because when Reuven, Gad, and half of Manasseh, these tribes want to say to Moses, we want to settle on the other side of the Jordan. What Moses doesn't say is, okay, we'll just conquer that too. No, that's not part of the promised land. Therefore, it is not ours. So yeah, there is definitely a warlike ethos in the ancient world, and Israel is part of it. But at the same time, there's also a sense of this far and no further.
Gershon Hepner asks, is excommunication necessarily synonymous with cancellation? Is it not canceling the Hasidut of Hasidim whom they wished to excommunicate?
Right. So it's not, as our very erudite questioner knows, because I know him to be erudite, canceling suggests that there's never any, part of this, what the cancellation question is, there's no way back. There was always a way back for people who were put in cherem. There was always tshuva of different kinds. And eventually, obviously, what happened to the Hasidim was they became the mainstream. Not only did they rejoin the mainstream, but in some ways they became the mainstream. So yeah, cherem is not, I think, equivalent to cancellation, although they share many, many, many similar features. And in some ways, of course, the explicit, let's be honest, the explicit conditions of cherem could be more serious than cancellation. You can't come within so many feet of this person. You can't have any economic doings with this person, on and on and on. When the Jewish community really wanted to cast someone out in the wilderness, it was pretty close to the ice flow.
Let's see. I'd like to ask a slightly different thing. Rabbi Zachary Zisman, as a rabbi working on a college campus in Los Angeles, I have noticed a real lack of religious literacy among all students. I find that leads to a challenge when talking about things like God or other spiritual religious living, which can lead to canceling or even worse, calling people evil. How do you address the issue that despite my religious views being different than yours, that is, I understand God in this way, or I understand when life begins differently than you that life begins differently than you, reproductive rights, right, that I and you are not evil, is the question.
So the first thing that you point to, which I think is one of the reasons why Jews like to talk about anti-Semitism, is because the other issues are even harder, right? I mean, there isn't nearly as much talk about Jewish literacy and ignorance as there is about anti-Semitism, because it's a lot harder to remedy that problem. And as you say, we're not the only community that suffers from it. But I may be wrong, and I'm certainly happy to be corrected on this. My own impression is that the vitriol doesn't come as a result of lack of knowledge. It comes as a result of excess of certainty and being on the team, and the idea, especially around something as charged as reproductive rights, that for someone to disagree with you is not a philosophical difference, it's a moral difference. And I think we need to relearn the possibilities of moral equivalency with in contrasting viewpoints. But that takes a lot of thought and work and time.
Randy Skirka asks, in Canadian schools, Erwin Kotler, the former attorney general, has been blocked from fulfilling his mandate of ensuring the IRA working definition of anti-Semitism adopted by Canada and Ontario. Jewish children as young as 3 years old are being harassed, for example, asked what flavor of gas they prefer. Horrible. What advice do you have for our community?
Not being intimately familiar with the particulars of the situation. I think we would use every means at our disposal. Protest, letters, lobbying politicians, speaking out. Also really important, which the Jewish community, at least in the United States, does not do well enough, identifying our allies. There are a lot of well-wishers and people who really would aid the Jewish community in efforts as we try to aid other communities in efforts. And so we need to build coalitions with other communities. And I don't think we do that nearly as well as we should. We talk a lot, for example, about coalitions and fractures with the African-American community, but the Latino community, which is really extraordinarily important in America, and Jews have built some bridges with them, but not nearly enough. So there's a lot of work to do with a lot of different communities that might be able to help. I don't know the particulars of the situation in Canada, but I will go on the record, having had him as a scholar in residence at Sinai, and saying that Erwin Kotler is a truly remarkable and wonderful human being.
Fully agreed. Bob Rosenshine from Jerusalem asks, what if any should be the limits on heresy free speech in a pluralistic society?
I like the phrase Bob Rosenshine from Jerusalem, because he and I both were born in Harrisburg and lived near each other when we were kids. But now he's from Jerusalem, because Harrisburg wasn't good enough for you, Bob, huh? Patrick, I don't live there now either, although a wonderful place to grow up, for those of you who live in Harrisburg. I think it's hard to abstractly put limits on, like, what should be the limits be. I mean, the obvious limit is incitement to actual physical harm or danger, the attempt to mobilize efforts against another group, but criticisms of groups or exploration of different possibilities of origins and ideas, the things that are so often shut down now, our rules are far too restrictive. And we have to really, I think we have to narrow our definition of harm, right? To say something negative about me is not sufficient for me to say that you have harmed me and those are bad words. I mean, the whole sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. That was a commonplace of growing up. And the only time I think that we have to really clamp down on that is when words are intended to be or likely to be incitement to actual physical violence or something equivalent to actual physical violence.
David, I think we could go on for a long time, but I have to be respectful of the limits on time for our audience. It's the lunch hour for many of them, and it's busy. I'm very grateful that you spent this hour with us. I'm very grateful for your consistently brilliant engagement with Sapir and what we're attempting to do, which is to have a deep engagement with committed Jewish audiences for the purpose of ensuring a thriving Jewish future, which we're doing under the auspices of the Maimonides Fund. So
let me just say back to you, not all writers are great editors too, but you're a great writer and a great editor and a fantastic controversialist and a good friend. So thank you.
Thanks a million, David, and thanks to our audience for listening in. We'll have many more of these conversations in the months and hopefully years ahead. So with that, have a lovely rest of your afternoons.